Happy New Year. Welcome back to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Here's the news today. $150,000. That's how much Seattle taxpayers are spending to settle a sexual abuse lawsuit against former Mayor Ed Murray. Here to explain, Seattle Times reporter Lewis Kam. Welcome, Lewis.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
This is the accuser that started the wave of allegations against Ed Murray. What did Delvon Heckard claim?
Well, initially, back in April, he filed a lawsuit that alleged that Mayor Murray, decades ago, when he wasn't mayor, obviously, back in the late 80s, had sexually abused him by repeatedly paying for sex from Delvon Heckard over a number of years in the late 80s. And basically, when he was a teenager and a drug-addicted homeless person living on the streets.
And Ed Murray denied everything you just said, so why is the city settling?
So as the lawsuit kind of went forward, people might recall that Mr. Heckard actually withdrew his initial suit and then later came back and refiled the suit that added the city of Seattle as a co-defendant. And the claim against the city was a little bit different than the claim against Mr. Murray. The claim against the city was that while Murray was in office, he made multiple public statements denying the allegations and, according to Mr. Heckard, came up with this defense that Mr. Heckard was a liar who was motivated by an anti-gay political agenda, and that the city of Seattle, as well as the resources at the mayor's disposal, helped the mayor perpetuate what Heckard called a fraud that defamed him. So it was a defamation case against the city, as well as a sexual abuse case against Murray.
And why is the Seattle taxpayer paying the $150,000 instead of
right.
Ed Murray, who faced the original charges?
Right. So as part of this lawsuit, then, the city faced the potential liability of this defamation suit. So from my understanding, speaking with city attorney Pete Holmes, he looked at the case and assessed it. They sent it to an outside a law firm to take a look at it and to offer an analysis. And what they came back was that this case could drag on for months, potentially years. And over that time span, the city was going to incur more money likely than it would if it just settled the case for $150,000. If they did fight it, if the city did decide to take it to trial and incurred these costs, it was possible that they could lose the suit. It was also likely that Mr. Murray was going to argue that under a state law that indemnifies government workers, or basically holds harmless employees for legal judgments and settlements when liability occurs while that employee was acting within the scope of their government employment. So the city, Mr. Holmes, decided, based on that assessment, that the words he used was this was a good bargain for the city to actually just cut the cost and pay out this settlement.
Well, Ed Murray may have argued that he wouldn't have had to pay this settlement, but is it clear to you, Lewis, that the city could not have made Murray pay if it had wanted to?
That's a question that would have had to been figured out in court. And there definitely is a state law that indemnifies government employees from when liability occurs on the job. The question, according to Holmes, is how do we kind of parse out the parts of the suit that are directed at the city versus what Mr. Murray did. Could we have done that successfully? Would Murray have had, a good, solid legal basis to shift liability onto the city if it came to that, if the lawsuit were going to go forward? These are all questions, according to Mr. Holmes, that we're going to have to play out over a large amount of time, probably. And on top of that, there was the possibility that a number of city employees as part of this lawsuit were going to be pulled into, you know, legal depositions and that sort of thing. So that the city decided it would be in the city's best interest to basically cut their losses and pay $150,000. $100,000 of that goes to Delvon Heckert. $50,000 of it went to his attorneys, who have decided they're going to, you know, send it off to sexual harassment recovery centers and that sort of thing. But Ed Murray himself didn't pay a dime of that. But what he did end up paying was for, you know, his own legal costs, which his attorney argues actually could have been shifted onto the city as well because of this intermingling of claims in this lawsuit.
As part of the city of Seattle settling this lawsuit, is Ed Murray admitting to anything?
No, he still denies that all of these allegations by Mr. Heckert, as well as the four other accusers who have come forward to accuse him of sexual abuse.
He's apologizing, sort of, right, as part of the, what did he say?
Right. So, you know, as part of kind of the resolving this matter, each party issued a statement, and the city gave its statement. You know, Delvon Heckert gave a short statement, and Ed Murray's it was actually longer than the others. And his offered some kind of apology, I guess. As you might remember, as this all unfolded, Mr. Murray took a lot of criticism for, in his public defense, basically attacking some of the accusers based on their, you know, their criminal past and their troubled lives, and contending they were, you know, not telling the truth and making stuff up and not credible. And a lot of people, there was a lot of backlash of, you know, that he was victim blaming. And so he issued an apology saying that basically saying, you know, if people interpreted my defense as victim shaming or blaming, that is, you know, that wasn't my intention, and I'm sorry for that. He also issued an apology to the law firm of Lincoln Beauregard, the Connolly Law Offices, for saying, it wasn't a direct apology. What he said is that he regretted saying that he wrote an op-ed piece, which basically suggested that the law firm was part of a grander right-wing conspiracy that had targeted him because of his progressive anti-gay political agenda, or I should say pro-gay political agenda. So he basically had said this firm was doing this because they were anti-gay and were coming after him. And as part of this statement he issued, he, you know, said he regretted making that statement.
Yeah, he said, "I regret an article we wrote that led many to believe that I was attacking victims or accusing the attorneys." And finally, Lewis, the current mayor, Jenny Durkan, says that this settlement of the lawsuit against Ed Murray allows our city to begin to heal. What about those other accusers? Are they suing the city, too? What happens next?
Right. Well, at this point, no one has sued other than Delvon Heckert. There are four other men out there who potentially could bring some kind of legal actions against Murray and or the city. Two of the accusers about 10 years ago looked at potentially bringing a civil suit against Murray, and that didn't go forward for issues dealing with statute of limitations, that sort of thing. The latest accuser, a cousin of his, of Mr. Murray's, who claims that he was sexually abused, these allegations occurred allegedly back in the 70s. Whether or not he would have a good suit or not, I don't know. But then there is the potential, I guess, to kind of, hey, would there be any sort of suit or claim there against the city for what Murray said publicly, if he said anything publicly at all, during his denials against any of these other accusers? I guess that is a possibility. Whether that will happen, that remains to be seen.
Seattle Times reporter Lewis Kam filling you in on the story. Lewis, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Bill.
Again, talking about the city of Seattle settling a sexual abuse lawsuit against former Mayor Ed Murray. That settlement will cost Seattle taxpayers $150,000. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm going to talk with the great Isabel Allende in just a moment. We're going to hear your New Year's resolutions, not for 2018, though that may come up, but I want to know, how did 2017 go for you? What did you learn? Stay tuned. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In 20 minutes, I'll ask you about your 2017 New Year's resolutions, something I don't think my next guest needs. I talked with world-renowned writer Isabel Allende late last year, and she does not seem to have trouble motivating herself. She's now written 23 books. That work ethic is one of many things her grandpa gave her.
Don't complain. Don't expect any help. Serve. Be responsible. Be honest. Don't whine. No time to look at yourself in the mirror. No time to be looking at your navel. No introspection. Just be out there in the world and work. That was the lesson. And it served me well. But now I'm 75 years old and I want to relax and have some fun, for God's sake.
Now, fans of Allende's writing will be glad to know that fun does not mean she has stopped writing. Her latest book is called In the Midst of Winter, and she loves coming to Seattle to talk about her books, even though Seattle memorably let her down once. She came back to Seattle specifically to buy a dress she saw in a window downtown.
It was a Lulu Lang dress that looked like a butterfly. And I came back to Seattle, took a plane, and came back to try the dress. I looked terrible. I looked like an extra in the Cirque du Soleil.
So the dress was a work of art, but maybe not a garment for you at this time.
Few garments are for me. I can only buy off the rack a Snoopy pajama, probably. The rest needs to be adjusted.
I see. Well, I'm so glad you're here doing a public radio interview. However, I understand that romantic and strange things can happen when you do public radio interviews.
I know.
Yeah, would you tell that story?
Well, I had... First of all, let me refer a little bit to the book.
Yes.
That is called In the Midst of Winter. And it refers to those emotional winters that we all go through in our lives sooner or later. And at the time when I started writing this book, I had been going through one of those long emotional winters, because I had divorced my husband after 28 years of marriage, and I had loved that man very much. My beloved agent, Carmen Balcells, died suddenly. Three of my best friends died, and my dog Olivia died. So it was a time of sorrow somehow. And then I started writing this book, and as it usually happens, the book pulled me out of whatever depressive mood I was in, because I was so interested in the story. And I started the book on January 8th.
As always.
As always. And then around May, I got an email in my office from a guy who had heard me on NPR, a widower from New York who was driving to Boston, and he pulled over because he heard me on the radio. And he didn't like what I said. I have no idea what I said. And so he emailed the office. And we started corresponding. I would answer sometimes, but he emailed me every morning and every evening for 5 months. I mean, the patience of this guy and how stubborn he is. Uh-huh. And so eventually we met in New York in October, because I had to go to a gala of the Center for Reproductive Rights. And so I invited him to the gala. We met there among many, many other people. And the next day we went out for lunch. And the main course was ravioli. And I thought, what am I doing here? So I said, look, what are your intentions? Because I'm 75 years old, I have no time to waste. If somebody says that to me, I would have run away. Mm-hmm. But he choked on the ravioli, that's true. But he survived. And now he's moving to my house in a few weeks. He sold his house, he got rid of everything he owns, and he's coming with a bike and his clothes to live with me in a very small cottage where I live.
And it all started from him emailing you to tell you something he didn't like that you had said.
NPR, yes.
Wow. Miracles occur. Well, who knows what will happen after this public radio interview. Talking about your novel, Isabel, you once said that you don't know what your book is about until you read the reviews.
Yeah.
And I took that as a joke, but then I wasn't so sure. Half joking?
half joking, because I think I'm writing about something, and then in the review, or because somebody gives me an insight or a feedback, I realize that the book taps into something that was important for me all my life, and I hadn't sort of put it in words. And then when let me give you an example. When I wrote Island Beneath the Sea, that's a book about the slave revolt in Haiti 200 years ago. Culturally, it has nothing to do with me. We never had plantations in Chile. We never had African slaves. Why would I spend 4 years of my life researching this very difficult book? And I was obsessed with it until I wrote it, never knowing why, until when the book was done, I realized that the theme of the book is absolute power with impunity, which is the power of the master over the slave. That's the worst example of it. But we have power with impunity everywhere. We are seeing it today in politics everywhere. And that has been an obsession even before the military coup for me. Because I grew up in the 40s in a patriarchal, conservative, authoritarian family where authority was never questioned, and it had impunity. It was not accountable.
In your own family.
And in the society where I lived.
Mm-hmm. Well, has that happened with this book, In the Midst of Winter? Have you learned anything about what your book is about?
Yeah, I remembered what I knew. I have been in other winters in my life, and some of them have been much deeper and longer than this one, the latest one. For example, the winter of my daughter's demise.
Paula.
And I had forgotten that there is always an invincible summer waiting to manifest itself if we give it a chance. No winter lasts forever. And so often nowadays, when people seem so depressed because of politics and how divisive the country is and how gloomy everything looks, I always remind people there is an invincible summer. The summer is waiting under the surface. These are bad times, but they will not be forever. We went through 17 years of dictatorship in Chile where everything was controlled and repressed. There were no political parties allowed. And still, we got democracy back in a democratic process. So I believe that I'm optimistic without being Pollyanna. I really know that we evolve. Things get better. They don't get worse.
And Chile figures into this novel. For those of our listeners who don't know, would you remind them that your first cousin once removed was the president, the democratically elected president of Chile, who was deposed in part by the CIA. Would you mind telling us again what you remember about that day and those events?
Well, Salvador Allende had represented a coalition of parties of the left and the center called the Unidad Popular. And he was elected in 1970. Immediately, the conservative forces in Chile, and with the help of the CIA, tried to block whatever he tried to do in his government. For 3 years, we had a very, very bad political, economic, and social crisis. In March of 1973, we had parliamentary elections, and the Unidad Popular increased his votes in spite of the crisis. So then, the CIA and the military, the CIA and the right-wing parties decided that they had to, that there were no, sabotaging the government would not end the government. They needed something drastic. And so they provoked a military coup with the idea that the military will depose Allende and then call elections. That didn't happen. Allende died during the coup, and a brutal dictatorship began, with horrible repression and atrocities that were committed by the military.
The Pinochet.
The Pinochet regime that lasted 17 years. And many Chileans left the country. I was among them with my family. And others were arrested and disappeared, and their bodies were never found. Others were tortured. Many were executed without trial. there was no habeas corpus. You could be arrested and you couldn't even ask what had happened to the person. So in this book, I have three characters only, three of them traumatized, three of them living in a winter of their lives. One of them is Lucia Maraz, who is a journalist and a writer. She looks like me, but it's not me. It's a friend of mine.
And she looks like you?
In the sense that her life resembles mine, but that's because many lives of that time in Chile resemble mine. I was no exception. And so her brother disappears. She has to go into exile. She lives abroad, comes back, researches about the human rights abuses of the dictatorship, and writes two books. The second character is Richard Baumeister, who is a professor at NYU. And he teaches Latin American studies. And so he has invited Lucia to teach for a semester or two semesters. And the third character, and he also has been traumatized in his past, and we don't know until the end of the book what happened to him. And then the third character is a young woman from Guatemala, undocumented immigrant, who lives and works, almost slave work, in a household where she's the maid and she takes care of a kid. An event brings these three people together in the midst of a blizzard. So it's a real winter also. It's the winter of New York, January last year, and which I was there, so I really loved it when it happened.
And then, it was super warm, and then it turned
And then it turned to this blizzard, epic storm that paralyzed the state, really. So that was the glue I needed to put together all these characters and this event. And so that's what the book is about. And each one of them, of course, I didn't have to research for Lucia because I know the story very well, the story of Chile. But I did research a lot for Evelyn Ortega, the Guatemalan girl. Not only I had been in Guatemala, but I have a foundation that works with refugees and immigrants. So I have cases like the case of Evelyn Ortega. I didn't have to make it up. But I did have to research the gangs in Guatemala, the political corruption and all that.
Evelyn, among other things, has fled sexual violence. Why do you, and you said you've known many women like Evelyn.
Yeah.
And I don't know everything that you mean by that, but I wonder why do you think it is that sexual violence isn't something we talk more about when we talk about immigration, because it's an aspect that you seem to care a lot about.
Yeah, but because it's just part of the violence. It's almost taken for granted. In the case of Evelyn, her family, her two brothers are assassinated by the gang, by the MS-13, the worst gang in Central America and Mexico.
Which started in the USA.
Yeah, in LA. Mm-hmm. And it was exported back to Central America and Mexico. And it has 80,000 members, recognized members, and it's the most brutal organization, one of the most brutal in the world. And so they assassinate the brothers and they take revenge on the family. And so she's beaten up and raped as part of the process. It's not unusual that she would be raped. The only unusual thing is that she survives. And then she has to get out because she's a witness to what has happened. She needs to get out. And this is a young woman with no resources, with no family. Her mother has been sending money from the north, from the United States, for years. She doesn't even know her mother. So she travels to the United States. Now, all the traveling, the trip, the journey from Central America to the United States across Mexico is an ordeal, especially for women, because the smugglers are criminals, most of them. And they end up not only raping them, but sometimes abandoning them or selling them into prostitution, selling them to the gangs. So for women, it's really hard. And I've seen this. So to have Evelyn being the victim of sexual violence is not at all unusual. The unusual thing would have been if it didn't happen to her.
Yeah, and yet that's why I asked about it. Yet it's not something that gets talked about so much, even though we talk about immigration constantly.
And we don't talk about domestic violence. Women who come here seeking asylum because they're running away from domestic violence. One of the cases that my foundation saw, the husband and his brother, who systematically raped this woman, broke both her legs with a baseball bat. And this woman practically crawled through the border to the United States looking for asylum. But domestic violence is not considered, usually not considered, like a reason to grant asylum. No, the situation is really hard.
This is fiction. And by the way, my guest is Isabel Allende. The novel is In the Midst of Winter, and it's a fiction. And we're talking about politics. Is that what you want to happen in your reader?
No, I want to tell a story that matters to me. I want to have characters that speak for me. I couldn't possibly write a book about Wall Street, but I can write about this because I care for this and I know it. But this is not a book about politics only. There are politics. Immigration is a big theme in the book, but it's also a love story between two people who are in their 60s. So it's mature love, which I care for at this time in my life. And it's about relationships. It's about loyalty, solidarity, and how we are or we are not willing to take risks to help another person. And when we do, things happen. In the case of Richard, the male character in this trio, is a man who is so guarded that nothing can happen in his life. He's insured against everything except his memories, because he cannot be insured against his nightmares. But he's insured against everything else. He has a little life. He doesn't want anything to upset that life. He's vegan. He has four cats. Well, he's based on my brother, actually.
Oh.
And that's my brother, a person who has such a perfect life that nothing can happen. But then it does happen. Sometimes it does. And then...
Has your brother read this book?
Yeah. Of course, he doesn't recognize himself in the book.
He doesn't.
And when something happens in his life that tests him, we see the character. We see what kind of person he really is. And then he opens up. And by taking risks that he would have never thought he could take, everything happens in his life. Good things.
Do you mind yet one more person telling you what happened in their mind as they were reading the book?
Of course, tell me.
Well, the two main characters, Richard and Lucia, reminded me of this country, because we're not a young country anymore. It feels that way, especially now. And there's this white man and a Chilean immigrant. They can't seem to connect, and an undocumented immigrant sort of brings things to a boil. And in the end, it's a hopeful story,
you know? It's a story of redemption, yes.
Starts with a pot brownie and ends up with love, but man, there's hell in between. But I wondered whether you wanted us to be thinking about 2017 politics when we're reading this.
No, because the country was not as divided and polarized. There was not so much hatred in the air as now when I wrote the book. Only a year ago, in January of last year, when I started the book, Trump wasn't even a candidate. He became a candidate around May. And by the time I finished the book, he wasn't president even. So, but the issue of immigration and many other issues that are in the book were in the air. Trump didn't invent them. He just harvested the worst and created this movement that has divided the country so badly. In the book, at the end, there's what I love, and I have this in many of my books: poetic justice, a sort of redemption that comes from sometimes bypassing law, the judiciary system, bypassing what is legal, and just focusing on what is human, what comes from the heart, what really has to be done to help someone. And sometimes it's illegal. So be it.
That seems to be a theme with you sometimes. You
it
wrote
is.
About Zorro,
yeah.
Right? Doesn't Zorro redeem outside the law?
Yeah. I don't trust the system. most of the time. Remember that I lived through the dictatorship. In 24 hours, the legal system was demolished. And people had no rights of any kind. Anything could happen and no one would be punished for that. So I have seen how easily it can collapse. How easily we can violate the law. I recently was at the African American Museum in Washington, and there's a whole section about lynching. And I was so horrified at how that was almost legal. Almost legal. People were sending postcards to their friends with images of lynching. And more than 4,000 people were lynched in this country. And this was, did the law intervene? It didn't. So I don't trust the law much. But I trust the human heart. I think that if we have a chance to hear another person's story, to see another, look at another person in the eye, no matter what the color, from where they come, what language they speak, what faith they have, we can connect.
That is optimist, writer, philanthropist Isabel Allende. Her new book is called In the Midst of Winter, and I talked to her late last year. We talked, among other things, about politics a little bit in there. I have a bit of news to pass on today that you'll hear more about this afternoon. In the news today, Orrin Hatch, retiring Republican senator of Utah, the longest-serving Republican in the Senate, more than 40 years, chair of the Finance Committee. He's a big deal, and he said today he's done after this term, which means Mitt Romney might run. Mitt Romney's moved from Massachusetts to Utah, and unlike Orrin Hatch, Romney's been a vocal critic of President Trump and could be another Republican senator who doesn't cooperate with the president. We'll have more on this later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. And in just a moment, I'm taking your New Year's resolution story from 2017. How did it go? Success, failure, what did you learn? Give us a call right now. Here's the phone number, 206-543-5869. Again, 206-543-5869. Call and tell us a story. Thanks. Happy New Year, and thanks for tuning in to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. 1 year ago, I made a New Year's resolution, and I followed the advice that the experts give you. It was a SMART goal. You know the acronym thing? S-M-A-R-T. It was specific, measurable, agreed upon, realistic. Maybe it wasn't time-based enough, because I failed. I'll tell you what. I'll tell you my resolution story if you'll tell me yours, and we'll all improve together right now, or we'll all agree to stop making New Year's resolutions. Give me a call right now, 206-543-5869, and we'll ring in the new year with a lesson learned. 206-543-5869. And I asked my colleague, KUOW editor Jeannie Yandel, to join us. Hiya, Jeannie.
Hello.
You made a SMART New Year's resolution, I think, last year. It was very specific.
It was very specific. My goal was, or my resolution was, to sing the Van Halen song Panama at karaoke before the end of 2017.
Let's put us in mind, sure. Shall we? Let's take you back to 1984.
Let's.
I know it was 1984 because the name is right there in the album, the Van Halen album.
That's
so,
true.
Jeannie, I got to know why Panama?
Okay, well, I wanted to sing this song at karaoke because here it comes, actually.
Yeah.
Bring it up. That's why, because David Lee Roth yells Panama, and then there's this amazing Eddie Van Halen guitar thing that comes in.
And that's why you wanted to sing it at karaoke.
That's exactly why.
Because it's
it
as if you were cueing Eddie Van Halen with your voice.
Yes, that's exactly right. I was just screaming Panama and then looking at Eddie Van Halen, and that magic was happening.
Well, why was this important to you? Was it just, could it have been any song? Was it about doing something in public?
It couldn't have been any song. I like doing karaoke in general, not because I'm a strong singer, but because I just sort of enjoy the chutzpah that comes with having to do something like that.
Yeah.
And Panama seemed like enough of a challenge that would also allow me to yell Panama in front of a room full of people, the way hopefully David Lee Roth does. But it didn't, So I did it.
You succeeded.
I did succeed, but it wasn't as gratifying as I thought it was going to be, because it turns out the only reason anybody likes that song is because of David Lee Roth yelling Panama. So everybody in the room yells Panama, and then he makes up nonsense for the rest of the song, and there's a spoken word section that doesn't make any sense, and it just, it's a bad karaoke song. It is not anthemic.
Well, then what's the lesson? What lesson did you learn from succeeding at a bad resolution?
Yeah, right. Okay, so what I learned was it was way more gratifying to practice singing along with the song in my car during my commute.
Hmm.
It was really fun to do that at 7:30 in the morning, and in fact, I still do it. It's sort of my get ready for the day thing. I would like to be the person who meditates every morning, but I'm the person who sings along to Panama every morning on my way to work. That's who I am now.
How about you? 206-543-5869. We're learning together. What was your New Year's resolution for 2017, and what did you learn from it, whether it was pass or fail? 206-543-5869. We have my colleague, KUOW editor Jeannie Yandel here, and we have Ted in Edmonds. Ted, what was your 2017 New Year's resolution?
My resolution, as weird as it sounds, was not to leave the house wearing sweatpants.
Why not?
I work from home when I'm not traveling, and when you work from home, you can get into a rut of getting up, showering, throwing on sweatpants, whatever's most comfortable, and not changing for the rest of the day.
That sounds great.
And it does sound great. It is great. I did it for a lot of years, but you start to realize it just becomes laziness when you get up every day and put on sweat. So I thought it would be a small way to stop being lazy and have laziness affect other parts of your life.
Well, what's the downside of the laziness? You're comfy. What's the problem?
Well, being comfy is not a problem, but when you start to get lazy with what you wear, you start to get lazy doing other things too, potentially, you know.
Oh.
The effort you put in at work, your kids, all that stuff, the abuse you take from people at Starbucks thinking you don't have a job because you're wearing sweats every day.
Okay, so it was all starting to slide a little bit.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Exactly.
And how did you set about to accomplish your resolution? That must have sometimes been hard if you just wanted to be in sweats.
Yeah, it was. I mean, first of all, I got rid of the sweatpants I usually wore, other than stuff for painting the house. Second of all, you just get really comfortable jeans or other pants. And
no
then,
one's judging you for your comfortable jeans?
Nope, no one's judging you for your comfortable jeans.
Interesting.
And then you cheat a little bit in the summers by finding a pair of sweats and cutting them into shorts and wearing them out when you're running errands.
Okay, so cut-off sweats are better than long sweats?
They are, because they just look like shorts. People don't know if you just were working out or playing basketball or doing whatever.
Are you wearing sweats at all anymore, even at home?
Oh, yeah, I'll wear them at home or doing projects around the house, things like that.
Okay. Do you mind sharing a 2018 resolution? You said you did a health goal?
Yeah, so, you know, the one everyone does, trying to exercise 4 times a week. And cutting all sugar out of my diet for a month, see how that goes, and keep it going.
Whew, that sounds harder than the sweatpants resolution.
It is. I probably won't be able to keep it.
Oh, no. Then you're going to have a loss. You're going to be back to the doubting Ted. You might doubt yourself. Keep the bar low.
Just do 1 for 3. That puts you in the Hall of Fame in baseball.
That's true. 1 for 3 ain't bad. All right, Ted, well, thanks a lot. Coincidentally, I resolved to not judge people by their attire, their sweatpants. So that's in. We're going two different.
Not everyone wearing sweats is lazy all day.
That's right. Less judgmental in 2018. Ted, good luck on the sugar and the health, and thanks for sharing a sweatpants success with us.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it, Bill.
Jeannie, sweatpants shorts, okay. Long sweatpants, unacceptable.
I'm skeptical of this. I feel like he was trying to cut corners on his own resolution. I mean, I'm glad for Ted, like that this was a thing and it worked, but you cut the bottoms off sweats and they're still sweats.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, my lesson from that was to have a resolution that you can easily, you can help yourself, because he got rid of his sweatpants.
That's true.
You know, and the stigma against walking without pants at all outside of the Starbucks is even greater.
That's a good point.
We're talking resolutions of 2017, 206-543-5869. Emmy in Ballard, what was your resolution?
Well, my husband was horrified when I told him that my resolution was to spend a lot of money in 2017.
Oh, yeah?
But part of the motivation for that was that we're getting on in years, and we're not going to have a lot of time to do some things. So The first thing we did was we went to Molokai for 2 weeks. Then we came home and bought a new Subaru. Then I went to adult music camp for a week. Then we went off to Greece and Amsterdam for 3 weeks. And then before that in June, we celebrated our 30th wedding anniversary, and we decided to have a large dinner party for family and friends, which turned out to be a blast. I think it was the hottest day of the year that day in June, and it was just so much fun, and it was a fabulous year.
Emmy, a couple questions. Do you have any hesitation in crowing about how much money you're able to spend? Because I'm not
apparently
sure.
Apparently, not much.
Yeah, I guess not much. Because some of us. Yes, go on. Some of us might feel kind of sheepish.
Almost everybody is going to leave their family something when they croak, and we figured, you know, let's just enjoy it while we can. So.
Wow. Well, yeah. I don't know if everyone's leaving something, but you're enjoying it right now. Do you have kids?
Oh yeah, they're all grown.
How do they feel about you spending their inheritance in Molokai and Amsterdam?
You know what? I'm afraid to ask.
Resolve not to ask in 2018.
That's another one.
Okay, so any final lesson learned from us that we can take away? What do you want to tell us?
That if you go ahead and spend money that you have, I don't advocate spending money on credit, that you will, you know, when you're lying there on your deathbed, are you going to be sorry that you didn't spend that money, or are you going to be sorry that you did? I think you're going to appreciate the fact that you had a good life while you could still ambulate.
Yeah, I'm with you, Emmy. If you're lucky enough to have it, time at some point becomes more precious than money.
Absolutely.
Enjoy that time. Emmy, thank you.
You betcha.
I'd like to hear from you. 206-543-5869. There's a lesson from Emmy's point of view. New Year's resolution for 2017, how did it go with you? What did you learn? Jeannie, what have you learned about New Year's resolutions? You did your own and you kind of looked around.
Well, I learned that that achieving the goal with my resolution last year is not that that's not the point, mm-hmm. right? The point was that I got this other habit that turns out to be really beneficial and is a stress releaser. I sing Panama in the car on my way to work and mm-hmm. I come in ready to go.
Yep.
And I've also learned that, am I jumping the gun by saying I'm not on board with New Year's resolutions at this point?
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
You're done with that? You resolve to not resolve?
I think so. I mean, I think my resolution,
why?
Because I was at a New Year's party yesterday. Here's why. I just learned this yesterday. It's a new lesson. So I'm at a New Year's party yesterday. It started at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. All of the adults are day drinking, eating barbecued ribs, and they're talking about how their resolution for the year is drinking less, eating better, exercising. And then they all say, well, obviously I'm starting that tomorrow. And it occurred to me, like, why bother?
Mm.
Like, why pretend you're going to be somebody else tomorrow, or that you can flip a switch and then you're going to be, you know, eating better and, you know, doing everything differently? I don't know. I don't know if we need to put that much pressure on ourselves.
Well, one reason, too, is that, as you said, you backed into a good new habit just by singing Panama in your
true.
Car. And let me quote one of our Facebook members here. Leah writes into us, one New Year's resolution I made about 5 years ago, I believe I've successfully kept. I wanted to take more time to try to understand the intention behind the actions of people I didn't quite understand. I felt and still feel that if we are more cognitively empathetic of others, then we will struggle less to find a middle ground.
That's an amazing resolution.
It's pretty good.
I feel like Leah's probably a better person than I am.
Right.
But I'm also curious to know what concrete, specific steps Leah took to get there, because that's a huge goal.
Yeah.
That's a huge resolution. I would love to know what little things she did along the way to make that bigger change.
Good question. How did you accomplish it? Because that's part of the SMART goal thing, right? They say break it down into, all the experts tell you, break it down into something doable. Elizabeth writes, quitting smoking nasty cigs 4 years this month. It's tough to quit, but the discomfort and withdrawals don't last long. I did it using the patch. So I guess there's her answer. She didn't have to. She makes it sound like she didn't have to struggle at all. She put on a patch and it was done.
Yeah.
This leads me to my failure story, that I resolved last year to swim the crawl for 10 laps. I just cannot. I get so out of breath, out of proportion to how physically taxing it is. And so I took concrete steps. I set up lessons, and that felt like a victory. I attended the lessons. That felt like a victory. And I have not swum more than 3 laps back and forth. It still wears me out. So I failed, even though I feel like I had it going. I did everything right except the learning to swim the crawl for 10 laps.
I have to say, though, that doesn't sound like a failure to me. You set an arbitrary goal of 10 laps, but you made progress towards doing something that you couldn't do before. And that feels like a big deal. I mean, that feels like something you could pat yourself on the back for.
I can break my arm, pat myself on the back for all the things I failed
Don't
at.
Don't sprain your wrist patting yourself on the back for that.
543-5869, Jennifer and Winthrop, will you enlighten us? What was your 2017 goal?
So my goal for resolution. 2017 was to learn how to smoke pot since it became legal.
Oh, why did you? So you hadn't smoked before, but you wanted to?
Well, when I was in college, I did a couple of times, but it made me really super paranoid, so I just couldn't do it. But then I decided this was going to be the year that I was going to learn how to do it.
Why would you want to do something that made you super paranoid?
Well, that's a good question. I was hoping that maybe it had changed somehow or that I had changed somehow. I mean, a lot of my friends really enjoy it. I have to admit that, you know, my older kids enjoy it. So I was like, you know, maybe it's time for me to try to enjoy it again.
And so how did it turn out? How did it turn out?
Well, I have to say that the pot that I tried when I was in college is a lot different than what they're growing now.
And so I've heard.
It was quite a different experience than when I tried it in college. I'll just say that.
And so then the lesson is what for you and for us?
The lesson is that as a 49-year-old woman, I probably don't need to try different. Even if it's legal, I don't need to try different kind of drugs, I guess I should say. I should just stick with what I know.
So that's kind of a new idea. You go for a resolution and find out you didn't really need the resolution anyway, and that's a success in itself, or at least a lesson learned.
Exactly. And so I decided that the better thing for me to do here in Winthrop, Washington, is just put on my skis and get out and find my high by skiing around in the mountains and enjoying my life that way.
You're right in the Medav Valley. You should be high all the time.
Exactly. We just moved over here 3 years ago from Seattle, actually. And it's a pretty amazing experience.
Well, Jennifer, thanks for listening. How do you listen to us in Winthrop?
Online.
Love it. Thank you for learning a lesson and telling us about it.
Yes, of course.
It's 206-543-5869. Michael and Everett, what was your 2017 New Year's resolution and your lesson learned?
To move my mother from Missouri to St. Louis, from St. Louis, Missouri to Seattle, start a business, and to get off of parole.
Move your mom from Missouri, start a business, and get off parole. And how did all of that go?
I actually accomplished all three.
How'd you do that?
Just thinking there was no other option.
Oh.
I just made it a part of daily life to not think that there was another option. You know, we fail every day, so don't look at failure as a means of stopping. You have to live. Make it a part of your daily life to just do whatever it is you set out to do.
Do you have any advice for us when it comes to changing our mindset so that we don't feel like failure is an option? It's just part of our daily life.
Well, that actually, to me, changing your mindset is actually a physical thing. In order to change your mindset, you have to make it physical. You have to physically get out and do things that's different, that's challenging, and that you have to think about. You have to think about how to accomplish something new. You're not dwelling on what negativities or what obstacles that you may have to go through or already have went through.
Michael and Everett, thanks a lot for the advice.
Hey, no problem.
Congratulations 3 times. I like that, Jeannie. I like the idea, the advice of doing something physical that it changes what you do, as opposed to sometimes I just sit around and think I'm gonna think about how I should think better.
Yes,
and I think that's true. We exist in bodies, evolved in bodies, and to go out and do things physically different is probably smart.
I loved that. And I loved, I mean, I want Michael to be my life coach. I mean, I loved how he said that idea of that you're going to fail, but that's not an end point. Failing is just a thing like any other thing that happens to you, and you keep moving no matter what. That I love that so much. It's a different way to think about failure. Thank you, Michael.
I do swim more than I used to, even though I failed at the 10 laps. I do like swimming. I learned a couple of things. Here's one that I borrowed from somebody I heard. If you can do it in less than a minute, just do it now. That really has stuck with me. It's so specific, and you'd be amazed at how often you use that. Take out the recycling, hang up the clothes, sweep the floor, water a plant. You can do a lot in 1 minute. So I recommend it. Cindy in West Seattle, what was your 2017 resolution?
It was to complete one project.
What kind of project?
I'm a illustrator, and so I wanted to complete one illustration project.
And?
No.
You didn't?
I did not.
You could draw a stick figure. I mean, at least you completed something.
Well, yeah, like I've sketched things out, but I think it's about getting doing the whole process to an end product. And I got really close a lot of times.
We're right at the end of the hour. What did you learn?
I reset my goal for this year to also be to do one project. So I'm just going to keep trying. I've learned that I just got to keep on keeping on.
Cindy,
I'll get there someday.
KOW believes in you. Keep at it, and let's talk next year about your success, okay?
All right.
Thanks. Cindy. Thanks, Jeannie Andel.
Thank you, Bill.
Good job on singing in your car and at karaoke.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing your lesson. Join us on Twitter at KOW, and stay tuned to KOW Seattle, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.